Welcome to another episode of the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. And there we have it. Welcome to a very special Good Books series strand episode of the Good Listening To Show, Stories of Distinction and Genius. The series strand that, by the way, Steve Cole, prolific children's author and editor, you've got over 150 books to your name. This is a series strand that could have been written in your honour. You're extremely welcome. You had a vision 40 years ago in, I think you wanted to win a series of target books. You entered a competition, and then in terms of a destiny fulfilled, 40 years later, you end up being the editor of the books you didn't win 40 years ago. So you're extremely welcome. You have, as I say, many, many books to your name, but most extraordinarily, you're part of the Ian Fleming Foundation. You are the Young Bond author. You succeeded Charlie Higson in that regard. There's loads to talk about. You've also got the prolific Astrosaurs children's series as well, which has put you in the top 10 children's books list for many years, I believe. So you're extremely welcome, Steve Cole.
Thank you so much. How nice to be here.
And you did mention just before we got going, you actually went to bed at 4:25. Would you like to just tell us the story behind the story of that?
Well, this is a fairly common thing in my life when a deadline nears. I am extremely talented at procrastination. It's one of my superpowers. And sometimes you just need that massive sort of rush when you're trying to finish something because it should have been finished several weeks ago. So, yes, it was good to get that done. And, you know, it pits you against a story, and it's a race to the finish, and that adrenaline and exhilaration kind of comes out in the writing, I think. So I never feel that my writing suffers for a late night. It feels like it's almost a comforting part of the process. But we'll come to all that in good time, I'm sure.
Yes, and are you going with Procrastination is a Superpower as the book title, or that's not the book title?
No, but it should be. That would be that'll be the story of my life when I write that on my deathbed, having put it off until the very last breath of life. That's when I shall suddenly produce my wisdom. It'll be too late by then, I'll be, you know, but, you know, there'll be a certain joyous irony in that.
And it is the stereotypical pain of being an author, isn't it? The idea that it is flooping hard work and deadlines are the bane that cause all sorts of procrastination, as you mentioned as well.
Yes, but I think it's also part of the process. I've kind of learned to stop beating myself too much about it. And, you know, my house thanks me because, you know, it's never looked tidier than when a really pressing deadline is bearing down on us. So it's like, you know, Douglas Adams talked of you know, how he loved deadlines because of the lovely whooshing noise they made as they flied over his head. I kind of feel there's some good deal of truth in that, although my deadlines, they tend to be like doodle bugs, you know, you sort of like hear the engine approaching and then the sputtering out, you know, it's going to crash on you any second.
And you mentioned that the house is tidiest. Is that because you procrastinate by doing a side activity and displace activity of tidying up all the time?
Yes, the washing up, the hoovering, the washing, all these things, which traditionally are not a favorite activity, suddenly become hugely important. You know, I'm sure I'll be able to write far more efficiently if I just mop up that spill in the utility room that I left 2 weeks ago. The time has come, you know, a time and place for everything.
In parallel universes, it's when a pregnant woman stereotypically thinks it's a good idea to start toothbrushing behind the fridge. You know, people get incredibly clean, as the idea of the baby's imminent, so I must toothbrush the back of the fridge.
Yes, nesting instinct comes in. Maybe it's my nesting instinct to try and curl up in a nest and forget I actually am a writer.
Yes. And by the way, when I first spoke to you, I was really struck with your vocal tones. You remind me of Oliver Postgate of Bagpuss fame. So as this is a good books series, John, I'm really hoping you may read an extract of what you might currently be working on later on.
Yes, indeed. And I was just glancing around here, Oliver Postgate thing I do have just there on the shelf. The Art of Small Films. There we go. So a lot of Oliver Postgate love over here.
Lovely. The clangers there on the front cover. I love that. And yes, Mr. Bagpuss. So you are, yes, you're the natural successor, not just to, you know, being the penner of the Doctor Who series of books, but also succeeding Charlie Higson in the Young Bond. But it's good to also be the Oliver Postgate successor by your vocal dexterity as well.
Well, I'll take that. Thank you.
And by the way, I first noticed you because a friend of mine, I think, had you doing a school's visit. Somebody called Celia Delaney appeared on Facebook standing next to you. I've since really enjoyed researching you on Twitter. There's a lovely sequence of you getting a load of primary school children to bark at you as you sing a song as well, because you're also a musician.
Yes. I do like a little bit of audience participation. I always believe a moving target is harder to hit. So when I am doing a show for children, I try and make it as lively and involving and interactive as possible. So yes, I've had children shout at me in schools all over the world. So you know, how lucky am I getting to play my ukulele at a frustrated pop star leanings come out here. You see, this is the some children's authors talk about school events as gigs, which I always feel is slightly. I don't know. I think that's kind of wishful thinking. We'd like them to be gigs, but I'm not sure that it can quite get that rock and roll. But they are great fun, and of course, it really connects you to your audience when you actually get to go out and meet them in the UK or beyond. So it's interesting going to international schools elsewhere and seeing that children are the same all over. There's something rather lovely in that.
And you've also co-written the hugely successful Swarms series with the British astronaut Tim Peake as well, haven't you? Because
yes.
I saw a picture of you on Twitter signing books that you co-authored with him too.
Yes, he's a lovely fella, Tim. Really have enjoyed working on him on the Swarm Rising books and also a couple of non-fiction titles. Someone said to me, why are you surprised that Tim Peake is so lovely and approachable and actually very down to earth for someone in outer space?
See what you did there.
Yeah. And they said that, why are you surprised? Because, his job is actually to get on with a very small number of people in a very, very tiny space in space.
Yes.
It's going to be nice. You don't want to sort of like annoy people out there because it's very difficult to flounce out and slam a door. You can't slam any door. Microgravity
really,
doesn't
really nicely put. You've got to be really pissed off if you're going to go outside the spaceship and slam the door. Quite right.
Exactly. Yeah. By the time you've suited up for your extravehicular activity, your rage and anger have probably subsided and you feel slightly foolish. You don't actually have to go out. So yeah, it's that all has equipped him very well for working with me. So that was was a fun experience.
Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to The Construct, and I'm delighted to be curating you through The Good Listening To Show. There's going to be a clearing, a tree, we're going to shake a tree, there's some storytelling apples, there's some alchemy, some gold, a couple of random squirrels, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, a golden baton, and a cake. Hurrah!
So all these things, all these
rituals. Absolutely all to play for. So, and also, if you have got a particular book that you'd like to read an extract from later on, you'd be very welcome to do that.
Lovely.
So let's get you on the open road. First of all, then, what is, where is a clearing like for you, prolific children's author Steve Curl? Where do you go to get clutter-free, inspirational and able to think so we can anchor the podcast around where you think your clearing is?
I was thinking about this, and I believe it's somewhere between Takapuna Beach in New Zealand and the moon. It's somewhere between the two. I think I've never felt so happy and soul rested as when walking along a New Zealand beach. The wide open spaceness of it makes it a balm for the soul. It's not like a British seaside, which is like overdeveloped and overcrowded and People desperately pitching their windbreaks wherever they can. In fact, they can be quite deserted because there's just so much space over there, of course. And looking out, you know, over an extinct volcano and staring down at the vast gelatinous corpse of an unknown jellyfish, these things add interest and spice to the beach visit. But then I also, at nighttime, I have an alarm clock with white, glowing white numerals, and it gives it such a beautiful glow. It just makes me feel, as I lie in bed, I can imagine lying on the surface of the moon, looking up at that cold, silvery light. I always imagine what it would be like to stand on another world and look out and see different stars or a planet in the sky instead of a moon, you know. So I like to think that I'm on a stretch of Takapuna Beach, somewhere in the Sea of Tranquility.
Ooh, if I can just say the word delicious at this point, that's just lovely. And the moonscape brings us back into the clangers deliciously there as well. Wonderful. So that's great. I wondered if it was going to be a moonlit walk, but it isn't. You've just got both scapes there as a sort of magical vista now.
It's a walk lit on the moon. How exciting.
So did you say Takapuna?
Yes.
Takapuna.
Mount Takapuna is an extinct volcano. I did an author tour around Australia and New Zealand back around about 2011, 2010 maybe. I know it was when the Christchurch earthquake hit, because I was due to fly there just 2 days before that happened for the Christchurch festival. So it was rather alarming sort of sitting in Sydney and getting this phone call from a very panicked publicist telling me that they were going to have to divert my flight because the theatre had pretty much collapsed that I was due to be talking in, and the city was without electricity and running water, so it wasn't ideal. And of course, that storytelling part of you imagines, you know, what if I'd been there and sort of lived through that? So that would have been, you know, quite an exciting experience in some ways. But it's very easy to say that when you're far away from the action, you know, sitting on a little beach in Sydney.
But there you go, the stuff of fiction right there. Love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what a gorgeous appropriate clearing then. So we're in Takapuna Beach near the volcano that is dormant as we speak, and I'm going to arrive with a tree now to shake your tree a bit existentially, a bit deliberately, waiting for Godot-esque shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. So this is where you've been kind enough to prepare your answers to the 4-3-2-1 construct. 5 minutes to have thought about 4 things that have shaped you, 3 things that inspire you, 2 things that never fail to grab your attention, and then a quirky or unusual fact about you, Steve, we couldn't know until you tell us. So over to you to interpret the shaking of the canopy of your tree as you see fit.
Well, there fall them apples all around me. Things that have shaped me. Well, I suppose the obvious one in this regard is Doctor Who, the TV series, but also the books. You alluded to my entering a competition for the Target Doctor Who books when I was 5 3/4 years old. My mum filled in the little coupon for me. Tragically, never sent it off. So how was I expected to win if I never entered? I think it was because I got upset at the thought of my book being cut up. So actually, I entered on a piece of paper rather than the thing that she had filled in. But no, I never won. But I did love reading those books, because of course these were the days before videos and Blu-rays and DVDs and streaming and on-demand television. So if you missed Doctor Who, that was it. You never got to see the episode again, unless they might possibly, you know, repeat an omnibus edition or show a couple of stories the following year. But you know, those times were lifetimes to wait for a young child. My very first memory is of Doctor Who. It's of Sarah Jane Smith trapped in a ventilation shaft on board the Ark in space. And because I've been shaped by Doctor Who, I can tell you that memory must come from February 1975, when that program was broadcast. You might be saying, well, Steve, why? How do you know it wasn't the repeat of the Ark in space later that year? Well, because I can actually remember other episodes from season 12 of the show that year. The Doctor leaping away from electrical crackles onto a bed after a trap set by an agent of the Cybermen, for example, in Revenge of the Cybermen. Doctor reaching for his time ring on Skaro, then being almost zapped by a Dalek from Genesis of the Daleks. When you're a fan of a show like that, you end up being able to date your life fairly accurately, because the show stays with you. I remember that I was at a school fireworks display in November 1978 because I missed episode 2 of The Stones of Blood, for example. You know, this is the lunacy. I remember that my first hernia operation took place the day that the final episode of the 14-part Trial of a Time Lord story was shown in 1986. So life gets, annotated.
You're being a veritable Time Lord in any case, because you're absolutely anchoring your own life timeline to Doctor Who. I love that.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? And I think it's only really Doctor Who fans, or, you know, unless you have, you know, you're a Coronation Street fan and you have a really encyclopedic knowledge. I don't know, you sort of like, you can peg your life quite dramatically to key events. I know that football fanatics can also do this to a degree because they'll remember the scores or remember things. But I think when it's a drama or, you know, television is sending visual images into the head, you know, it's a slightly different, it's sending fiction in, and that's got to affect the synapses. I think it certainly affected mine. But
have you ever thought of going on Mastermind? Because I think we all know what your topic would be.
Well, this is it. Well, tragically, someone actually won Mastermind with Doctor Who as their specialist subject. So there'd be a lot to live up to there. So,
and did you watch that one and say you were basically chuntering off the answers before they were, presumably?
I was able to answer the questions, yes.
But in terms of destiny fulfilled, I know that you ended up being the audio producer for Big Finish, which is the whole Doctor Who series as well. So you really have managed to anchor your life to that as a purpose, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, you know, I actually, as you've mentioned, I edit the revived Target books, which, you know, novelise the TV episodes of the reboot of the series when it came back in 2005. But also in the late 90s, I was the editor of the ongoing adventures for Paul McGann's Doctor. You know, he came back for a TV movie in 1996, which sadly wasn't taken up into a full series, but the books developed his adventures. And when I was growing up, basically the guy who taught me how to read was Terence Dix, who was a script editor of the show from the late 60s to the end of the John Pertwee era, and then went on to write an awful lot of these Target books. You know, he had a very crisp, spare style, the way he would novelize these Doctor Who stories and, you know, kind of make them his own by doing that. And I saw him at my school library when I was about 8 years old, and again when I was 12 years old. And then I got to work with him. And the first book from BBC Books for The Eighth Doctor was called The Eight Doctors by Terence Dix. And I worked with him and got along with him well. And he actually dedicated a book to me one time, to Steve Cole, An Editorial Raft in the Stormy Sea of Deadline. And how extraordinary to have gone from reading this guy as a child to having him dedicate a book to me. I mean, that's a remarkable journey, and it's only possible due to the breadth of imagination and longevity of something like Doctor Who. So that's definitely one of my apples. That's probably the...
I would say it is, very profoundly. That's your big cruncher.
It is, as a cooking apple, yeah. I would say, because it's cooked up all sorts of things in my life. And, you know, in wider sense, another apple shaken from my canopy, I think, would be television. Not just the shows on it, but also its form and structure, which meant an odd amount to me. One of my favourite TV shows, rivaling Doctor Who for popularity in my affections, was the Incredible Hulk TV series made by Universal in around about 77 to 82, which featured Bill Bixby as Dr. David Banner, afflicted with the curse of transforming into Lou Ferrigno's Incredible Hulk. Now, I loved this show because it was taking comics and making them into something real life, so it seemed to me. I was aware of the fiction, though, very keenly, because when I played games of the Incredible Hulk, I was playing games of the Incredible Hulk television series, and I knew that there were two advert breaks in every hour-long story. So I would reach a pivotal point of my invented narrative, and then I would sit down for 3 minutes while the imaginary adverts played before picking it up and getting on with it. And I knew that he only changed into the Hulk twice per episode, for budgetary reasons, really. Although at the time, I just thought that was part of the fun of it. And my favourite bit was the build up when David Banner would get angry. That's when he transformed. You know, if he'd been beaten up or if he'd trying to save someone and was being frustrated by all the things in his path. And I think, you know, we can all relate to this, but especially children, when we feel powerless and, you know, frustrated, you know, we sort of cry with rage and anger, you know, and it all comes out in that tantrum, you know, and the Hulk is a tantrum turned green and made muscular. So we kind of lead up to these bits are the best bits. So yeah, I would make sure that, you know, just like on TV, I would be sitting down for the 3-minute ads, and then probably the Hulk would come and make his first appearance. So I was always
to Hulk up when you've been sitting down for 3 minutes. Is the
exactly
other
yeah? It almost gives you time to change into your ripped shirt and jeans combo, you know, which is important for the fiction of the piece. You know, things like the test card. I mean, I tell children today on school visits, you know, they have no concept of the idea of waiting to tune into a program, or very little idea of this, because they get what they want on demand. You know, they can stream at any time. They will never know that both the joy and frustration of having to wait a week to find out what will happen in the next 25-minute installment of Doctor Who. There's no binge watching. There's no shortcutting to get there. You have to wait.
And deferred gratification is a very important lesson of itself, which a lot of people lack now.
It is. Yes, and it is. I think it's actually more interactive than, you know, it's one of the watchwords for children, interactivity. Well, television used to be because you would actively see what was on and make a choice, as long as you're not just randomly flicking channels the entire time. And you know, by making a conscious choice to stop what you're doing and be there at a certain point in time is, you know, that's quite a beautiful thing, I think. But certainly I would end up watching anything because, again, I became fascinated by the test card. They literally would not even show TV all the time. Sometimes you just get that picture.
Yes.
Hours with music playing behind it. It was a girl playing noughts and crosses with a clown puppet.
Yes, and that was on Antiques Roadshow recently, where the girl was back with her board, and that was featured.
Really?
The grown-up version of the test card.
Oh, my goodness. It used to terrify me, that thing, because there were noughts and crosses on the board, which implied that the clown puppet had been animated to play against her. And the girl had this strange smile on her face, almost as if she just let one go and no one knew. And the clown was sort of like draped over the blackboard, and, you know, they'd be playing this sort of like cheery music. But I was thinking, if I take my eyes off this television screen and I look back, that clown's going to be right up in my face, like trying to get out of the television. So you can imagine if I could, like, you know, twist just a single still photograph with some colour bars around it into this horror story. I think it was a given that I was always going to transform ideas into words and
absolutely
make sense of them. So yes, I think that was definitely a spur to my imagination, rather than, you know, television was still treated as a bit of a menace back in the 1970s when I was growing up with it. You know, you mustn't spend too much time watching TV, your eyes will turn square. There was something, you know, some sort of danger of the passive consumption.
Yes, telly. Old square eyes. I remember that too, as a sort of encouragement to stop watching telly. Yes.
Yeah. And like, you're only allowed, like, you know, a smaller like window of children's programmes, you know, before the regional news comes on, you know, things like that. It sort of encourages you to go off and, you know, and do something else. But I think that actually some of those choices I made, you know, definitely had an effect on me.
Next Apple.
I mentioned The Incredible Hulk, and I think Marvel Comics are certainly something that shaped me as well. They were just as important as the Doctor Who books to me, and introduced me to this vast shared world, because the superheroes of Marvel didn't live in a separate universe. They lived in a kind of a mirror dimension to our own. It wasn't just Spider-Man who lived in New York City. It was also the Fantastic Four, and the Avengers wouldn't be far away, and Daredevil was there, you know. So it was, yeah, this shared world, and you never knew who was going to turn up in whose story. You would notice that they were drawn differently, or maybe scripted slightly differently, but that was part of the fun. But again, at that time, comics were frowned upon as an art form. They were kind of just considered, you know, just a bunch of characters in long underwear fighting each other and, you know, ridiculous, you know. But the truth couldn't have been further away from that. I still have in my possession two installments of Super Spider-Man and the Superheroes, the weekly UK Marvel comic that came out from 1976. And it was a two-part story. It was unusually, the comic was landscape in style rather than portrait. So you could fit two pages of Marvel action on every landscape page.
It's such a joyful, passionate, it's like a joyful geekery you're describing. It's so, so immersed in the passion for it.
I was a child, you know, I could tell, you recognize the difference. But this story was extraordinary. It was, it's basically revenge tragedy where Peter Parker's Spider-Man is battling the Green Goblin, Norman Osborn, and it's being a tangled web of connections. Peter's flatmate is the son of the Green Goblin, doesn't it? Harry Osborn. Harry Osborn at the moment is coming down from a really bad LSD experience. I mean, children's comics, really? You know, he's like obviously having a very bad trip indeed. But Spider-Man's fighting the Green Goblin. The Green Goblin has kidnapped Peter's girlfriend, Gwen Stacy, because he knows who Spider-Man is. And he knocks Gwen Stacy off the top of the George Washington Bridge. And Spider-Man, of course, saves everyone. He leaps to the rescue and he spins his web to catch Gwen. And it snags on her boot. Yes, he's got her. And there's the sound effects of like snick, I think it is.
Snick.
The jerk of her, the fall. She's already dead. She was, he thinks he's saved her and he realizes she's no longer alive and the goblin did it and he's going to kill the goblin, you know. There's part two of this. That's very dark, of course. You know, he's feeling this mourning, he's feeling loss and grief and rage, you know, and he beats the hell out of the goblin. The goblin then tries.
We're going into a slight rabbit hole of now going into a graphic novel of itself. So remember, I said occasionally I might go to get
us. Yes, I'm sorry. I'm getting
no, that's away. So lovely, though, because it's so, so passionate and ingrained in the fabric of who you are as a story spinner. Even the Spider-Man web, the spinning of the story.
Yes.
You're just ingrained by your narrative. It's fantastic.
But I think, the reason I think this truly shaped me is that, this allowed you to, comics allowed you to feel all these big grown-up emotions that you weren't ready to feel. It was aspirational reading in a way.
Yes.
You felt like I had to throw away so many comics from my bedroom by my mum. She made me clear them out. But those two comics, they stayed with me right from the age of five. 5 years old, I shouldn't have been reading about that stuff, or I shouldn't have been expected to understand that stuff. But I was able to understand the importance of them in the life of Peter Parker and that such important events could happen to us all. Mm. So it was very important to me at the time.
So to pull you towards another apple now, so this is the last shaping, and then we'll get into three things that inspire you.
Yes, well, it has to be music as the other shaping experience. Typically, I think, looking back, I didn't have any real discernible taste in music until I was about 15 when I discovered Factory Records in Manchester. And it wasn't just the music, but it was also the aesthetic. It was the idea that the records weren't just tools for selling songs. They could be objects of beauty in their own right, you know. Listening to New Order and Joy Division and A Certain Ratio, which has inspired me to make my own songs. And so I bought a keyboard and learned roughly how to play, make noise with that. And
there's a lovely through line of you being a collector here as well, because you're collecting stories, narrative, but also you're collecting now records as well.
Yeah, because songs, of course, can be important stories as well. And especially the ones that feel autobiographical. I mean, Ian Curtis of Joy Division, who tragically took his own life, it's hard not to see in the songs some of those darker impulses leading him there. Yes. You feel like you're, living through the real deal there. Mm-hmm. And so I started a band when I was 19, called Faces Fall, with reference to the slightly depressing genesis of this, with a guy I was friends with at Marks and Spencer's, where I worked as a Saturday boy. And Paul and I would sort of swap tapes originally, and then we started writing songs. He was playing the guitar, I was playing the keyboards and bass and singing. And, 30 years later, 30 plus years later, we're still in the band. In fact, this afternoon we're meeting for a rehearsal for a gig we have Friday.
Oh,
So,
how fantastic. And he's not
so
still at M&S, I'm assuming. Where is he now?
that now he's quite high up in Sony on the digital architecting side. It's interesting how his background was in sort of maths and sciences and numbers. Mine was in words, but it's been a real partnership and friendship that's transcended, all other relationships in my life.
And
And
if it's Sony PlayStation, for example, then that's extraordinary that he too is in the gaming world, which is linked to sort of graphic novels and the idea of creating universes.
yes, indeed. And I did actually use his name as a pseudonym one time when I was writing a Doctor Who short story and commissioning myself to do it because I needed to fill a hole in a 1997 anthology. I was able to pay Paul, and the
And
money
what's
went
his
to the
second name? You
recording program.
mentioned Paul, Mr.
Paul Grice
Paul
is his
Grice.
name, and the band is Faces Fall. You can find us on Spotify and iTunes and Amazon Music and all the rest. Yes, it's joyful being able to make music. And in fact, I think as the books have come to reflect an outpouring of one kind of creativity, which has been commercialized, the music is a way of expressing, I don't know, maybe a different part of me,
Yes.
and a different creative exercise.
And attached to your Twitter profile, I know there is a your one of your recent tracks is called Lockdown Punch Bag, and that's something people can find on the Steve Cole Twitter.
Yes, that's a little bit of an odd one now, yes, but of course written during lockdown when
Of
these things
course.
are so
And I'm
important.
assuming Paul's in there as well, is he, if he's part of your
Oh
band?
yes, oh
Oh
yes,
yes.
see Paul and Tony the drummer. Yep, we're and
It's lovely you're
another
still
lovely live
together.
version too. Yes, indeed.
And now I think we're on to, if I may, three things that inspire you. If there's any overlap, that's completely fine. So three things that now inspire you. This is the second of the apple crunchings.
Oh, it is, isn't it? Yes. We'll whiz through those because one of those that inspired me is Mr. Terence Dicks, and I've told you the story of him. He's no longer with us. He died just a few years ago, but he became a kind of elder statesman of Doctor Who because he joined during Patrick Troughton's time in 1968, and through his involvement with the books, not just novelizing other TV writers' episodes, but also generating lots of original stories of his own,
Yes.
which I was able to work with him. And he was
And did he
always.
always know that you perceived him as being your mentor, by the way? Did you have that conversation?
Yes, I think though he had more he'd been a mentor to much more impressive writers than myself. I think people like Stephen Moffat and Russell T Davies would say that they'd learned a lot at the knee of Terence Dicks from reading these books. We have this shared experience of it's not just nostalgia, it's a real shaping force.
Yes. Part of your DNA, it would seem,
Exactly,
yes.
yeah, and that you can see that coming out in different ways and different strands of stories. And I came back to work as the consultant editor on the Doctor Who list in 2017, and was able to work with Terence one more time before he passed. And it was lovely to catch up with him again and reconnect with a man who had been such an important part
Yes.
of my life in so many ways. When I was
Like an
watching him,
elder statesman within
exactly, this is
your
exactly
life.
what he was.
Yeah.
When I saw him aged 12 at Bedford Central Library, I remember thinking, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I thought I wouldn't mind being Terence Dicks. I would like his job. That sounds good, making up a Doctor Who for a living. And then, of course, you find yourself doing it at 4:25 in the morning with an interview to record the next day. And you think, yeah, this is exactly the kind of stuff he would have
Was
gone
it a
through.
Doctor Who book you were finishing this morning?
It actually was a Doctor Who short story I was finishing this. Another person who inspired me was Mr. Hall, my English teacher at middle school. I have my school report from that time, age 9 to 12, and age 9 English is clearly just another subject in the curriculum that I'm middling at. When I'm 10, I go up into 10I, Mr. Ian Hall. It was one of those teachers that can be very humorous and engaging, but also with the iron discipline that you don't mess. He encouraged you to be playful with what you did, but there were clear limits. He commanded the best from you. And he was a rotund gentleman. He was bald with his big red beard, and he would refer to himself as Baldilocks and the Three Hairs or something, you know. You know, he would send himself up, you know, which was, and I love that sense of, you know, not just teaching, but, you know, entertaining and encouraging. And he was my English teacher for the rest of my time in Lincroft Middle School. And you can see year on year through my report how my interest and my ability in the subject go up. And also my story writing increases. When we were tasked to write The Tropical Island Nightmare after watching Lord of the Flies, or reading Lord of the Flies, I think I ended up writing a 27-page epic, which was way more than required, but I just started enjoying it so much. And I realized that not only it was starting it and finishing it. It's yes. So important to finish something creative, because then you can look back on it and judge it as a finished work, even if
and that's so lovely and profound that, you know, what did you say? Not Goldilocks. You said something more witty than that.
Goldilocks and the Three Hairs.
Mr. Ian Hall. How lovely. Is he still with us, or you don't know?
I suspect possibly not now. Sure. But he was, yes, he was a great guy. And yeah, the other inspiration I'm going to name, Charles M. Schulz,
Peanuts.
The creator of Peanuts. Yes. For 50 years, you know, my lifespan, he created a comic strip, you know, 4 or 3 panel comic strip every single day. And a quote he gave was, the comic strip illustrator has to do the same thing every day without repeating himself.
Wow.
Which I thought was a lovely way of of approaching that job and creativity within it. On my shelf behind me in my clearing, I've brought with me the complete run of Peanut strips that were collected by Fantagraphics Publishing a few years ago. And you can see the evolution of the characters and also his style of telling stories, how that changes from 1950 right the way through to 2000. Mm. And you can also see how his philosophy pretty much stays the same, which is very interesting, the way he allows it out through his different characters. So I think that inspired me it was okay to write, you know, serious fiction and create a shared world like the Marvel Comics world, like the Peanuts world, where, you know, Snoopy would be, you know, sitting with Lucy one day and Schroeder the next, or, you know, they would all have these different interactions, and I found those fascinating.
Yes.
And wanted to explore them in my own work.
Lovely attributed, lovely attribute. I'm trying to say the word attributed, but we're in using in the right lovely to attribute Mr. Charles Schulz for that discipline.
Yes,
lovely. Now, two things that never fail to grab your attention. This is the borrow from the film Up. This is, well, squirrels, you know, what never fails to grab your attention, irrespective of whatever else might be going on for you.
Yeah, well, typos, that's a big one. That's a big one. If I'll be driving along and, you know, you see a sign for a shop,
yes,
and they missed out on apostrophe. You think, oh, you paid all that money for that sign and you didn't even check. Or it's painted on the side of a van, this beautiful logo or whatever, and, you know, they've misspelled a word, or, you know, I find it difficult.
There you are, chief constable of the grammar police. And
well, that's right. And it's so unfair. Discipline. It's so unfair, you know. But yes. I remember being on holiday in Rhodes, and this restaurant was advertising its way on this big neon sign, and it was offering lamp chops. And which, you know, was actually quite a beautiful, surreal moment. Imagine if you went in there, all full of yourself, saying, I think you mean lamb, and they actually served you up this sliced electric angle poise. I think the cachet of angle poise would be an interesting dish. But, and you know, come on, they're writing down English far better than I would Greek, you know, so it's, I'm aware of, you know, the ridiculous pedant in me, even as I say it, but... oh, I went into a store and bought some cling film, and oh, it said tear here, and they'd spelled tear T-A-R-E.
No.
That doesn't get my attention. That almost explodes my head, because it's something that's actually for sale in a major UK retailer. So I was shocked.
Give us the cough again. I missed who that was.
That was the one. How could they? But yeah, that grabs my attention. And the other thing to grab my attention, the other squirrel, if you like, is a salsa beat in
Oh,
music,
lovely.
because
Yes.
I'm a salsa instructor in my spare time.
I'm surprised you've got spare time with your mindscape being so brilliantly fulsome, but you're a salsa instructor. How extraordinary.
Yes, because the wonderful thing about salsa is that while you're leading salsa, you cannot be thinking about anything else because you're concentrating on what you're going to lead. You know, one movement leads to another, leads to another. And so if you ever get writer's block or a plot point that's just not working, you know, it's very good to go out and get 3 hours salsa in, because your unconscious works on it, or your subconscious works
Yes,
on it in
gosh,
the
how
meantime, and
extraordinary.
you come back to it and suddenly, oh yeah, I know what I can do now, because
Yes.
you've not been thinking about it for that time.
Yes.
So, and it's also very
Lovely.
good for working the hunched shoulders of the writer and the pins and needlesy arms. So, and it's not just salsa music that we dance to. You know, you can also dance to modern songs which happen to have that salsa rhythm. One, two, three, rest, five, six, seven, rest, one, two, three, five, six, seven. And you can hear it in everything from Taylor Swift's Blank Space to Lenny Kravitz's Mama. You know, it is, that rhythm can sort of like steal into something. So when I hear it, it puts me into a good mood and a happy place. And I imagine what
Yes,
I might
that's
do, what
very
routine.
relatable because of my passion and love of comedy improvisation with the mindset of yes and, yes and, yes and, yes and, which is just rhythm of I suppose, spinning narrative. So I like the fact you're using dance moves to just create movement, which then
Yes.
informs your storyscape.
Yes, and reflect the feel of the music as well, you know, in the way that you dance them.
And if I may, sorry to interrupt you, a quirky or unusual fact about you now we couldn't know until you tell us.
Oh, I'm made up of quirky facts. It's difficult finding a serious fact, really. Well, I can tell you that I have had four hernia operations in my time. Inguinal hernias, one at 15, one at 16, one at 19, one at 39.
Ah, why the 20-year gap between hernias? They sounded
Well,
quite
I
regular.
know. Well, one was on one side of the groin, and then the second one never healed that well, and that one kind of reopened and led to the third operation a couple of years later. And they must have done a slightly better job because it didn't reopen again until I was, 39. But I do also have a hole in my diaphragm, so a hiatus hernia as well. So I'm not
Ah.
entirely hernia free, but I'm basically riddled with hernias.
You are an holy man in
Yeah,
that
maybe that's my
Yeah,
superpower.
I'm riddled with hernias. That's a great, quirky, unusual fact. Thank you. If you'll forgive me, because I'm just sort of whistling along, making sure we hit to time. Now we've
Yes.
shaken your tree. We're still in your beautiful clearing. Just say the name of the beach again. We are it in New Zealand because it's such.
Acapuna Beach.
Acapuna Beach, lovely. And now we're going to talk about alchemy and gold. When you're at purpose and in flow, what are you absolutely happiest doing?
Well, it always used to be writing stories. Then I had a period of repetitive strain injury, which made typing very, very difficult and made this thing that had always been just an extension of myself become quite painful and difficult. I tried writing longhand, and it just wasn't the same interface between brain, fingers, and screen. You know, I tried dictating stories using the software, but oh goodness, I think on my YouTube channel there's a video of me taking 2 minutes to type three words
Wow.
with the power of Dragon Dictate. It wasn't a happy experience. I was ready to punch the screen, but you know, which probably would have made the RSI worse, if anything. It took a while to work through that. But I think it's those really late nights, early mornings, when I'm just completely locked down in the zone. When I was writing Young Bond, every story, every one of those novels, the last 8 to 10,000 words took place over this absolutely full-on 36, 40-hour period where I would not sleep. Start in the morning, work through the night, work through the next morning, get to lunchtime, finally pack up and send it off. So I felt like I'd been through the same stuff that James Bond had. I was battling the bad guy on a blazing Zeppelin, or fighting Nazis in a steampunk version of the Iron Man suit, or climbing a antenna to wrestling with the dilemma of whether to shoot a spy or not. I felt like I was living those things so vividly because the adrenaline is running and it's pushing you away. You want to stop, you can't give up. And so you have that same thing. It's like a It's like pitting yourself against the climax of something. And so the starts of books I find very, very difficult to do, even after all this time. I'll come down and say, well, I wrote chapter one today. And someone says, oh, that's brilliant. Well done. I say, no, I literally wrote the words chapter one. That's what I wrote, nothing else. But by the end, it's like 10,000 words.
So there's a natural momentum that picks up. And then in the end, it's a sort of lockdown of about 40 exactly, hours.
Definitely. It's all the work while crying. Yeah. It's yes. that thing, all the procrastination, all the plotting and planning leads to this.
Which, as you said, is your superpower, your capability of procrastination. Lovely. This is the good books moment now. Imagine, if you will, a plinth, a metaphorical plinth within the clearing, where we can talk about any of your past or current projects. So what book would you most like to feature, Steve, in what we're about to talk about?
Oof, you know, ideally, I'd need a clump of plinths, really.
That's a lovely collective noun for a bunch of plinths, a clump of plinths.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's the name of a review from the 60s. I think it's probably possibly Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, I'm not sure. More recently, I've written a lot of different books and different styles and genres in my time, but I've been writing what they call eco-adventures recently, because I've always enjoyed entertaining and distracting and trying to make people laugh, but you know, also stuff happens in the world that makes me sad and alarmed, and you realise what a privileged position someone in middle age inhabits just now at this point in the world's history, because we've inherited this system that has pretty much brought the planet to its knees, and it's children and their children who are going to need to do something about it rather urgently. And so I've just been using some of these issues as a backdrop to a story, not kind of like trying to preach to anybody or telling anyone what to do, but just to use a factual backdrop for a fictional adventure. It started with a book called Tin Boy, which was about the effect of tin mining in Indonesia, and how children are brought into impoverished struggles to get any tiny scraps of tin ore, which of course is used in the solder, which holds our gadgets together. Mm. The people who gather this raw material will never own a mobile phone or possibly many, many gadgets at all, but we just take them all for granted without thinking about how some of the raw materials were obtained. And I've written some other books since then, and the most recent one I wrote is called Stitched Up, which takes place in a sweatshop in Hanoi. Mm. It's about a unfortunate position with fast fashion retailers are trying to sell things very, very cheaply, and that means the production costs must be kept low, so they source them from factories in the Far East or abroad, and everyone takes their cut of the profits. So in the end, the actual suppliers can often only, you know, pretty much barely break even, and so coming to using slave labor, basically child labor. Yes. And tricking children into these situations by taking advantage of the gullibility or the lack of education in certain parts of the country. So, yes, it takes place in Vietnam, and I'm going to read a little bit where the main character, Han, is remembering how she was recruited from her home in rural Vietnam, ready to board a coach for Hanoi and a new life. She's been promised that she will work in a fashion retail outlet and that her parents will be given money for letting her go. The wage she earns will go to them to look after. The man reached into his jacket pocket for a wad of banknotes. He peeled off two notes, one pink, one yellowish green, and held them out to my dad. Dad hesitated. I met his look. His eyes were reaching for me, but his shaking hands were reaching for the notes. The man lowered his hand. Dad's fingers closed instead on a piece of paper held out by a woman. This is a contract, she told him. Terms of your daughter's employment. You will want to read it. Check everything is in order. My dad turned his eyes to the words on the paper, but he cannot read. He never went to school. No one in my family can read at all, apart from me. The contract might have said anything. I wanted to see, but I couldn't shame my father in front of them by showing he couldn't read. My mother went to the altar in the hall and said she would ask our ancestors for their blessing. They must have given it fast, because Dad signed the contract. The woman smiled, and the man handed him the two banknotes. Where you live, it would buy you maybe two cups of coffee. That day, it was enough to buy me.
Wow. And is this already published?
It is already published, yes.
And just say the title of it again.
It's called Stitched Up, from Barrington Stoke, the publishers, with gorgeous illustrations by Oriol Vidal. We've had a little partnership, the two of us, writing these books. There's four of them out there currently, and I'm due to start writing the next one today.
No peace for the wicked. You're straight off your 4:25 hitting the deadline to the next book now.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to award you with a cake now, if I may, and I've actually got a comedy cake here for you. You get to put a cherry on the cake with a favourite inspirational quote that's always given you succour, first of all.
Well, the inspirational quote, I'll take it from Doctor Who, the wisdom of Stephen Moffat, who said, or had the 11th Doctor say, "We're all stories in the end. Make it a good one."
Lovely. What's the what notes, help, or advice might you proffer to a younger version of yourself, Steve Cole?
Well, I was thinking this, and I was actually thinking, well, you know what? He's actually still very much inside me, that younger self. You know, if anything, my advice would be shut up and let the grown-up Steve Cole talk a bit now and then. Really, nice. just sort of like hold tight and ride out the blasts in life, and you know. Good things do come from more difficult situations if you give them the space. So I think I would say that, and advise him to lie down on the surface of the moon or on Takapuna Beach as often as he can.
And we're cramping up to a bit of Shakespeare, but via the Golden Baton, please. As you've experienced this from within, who would you most think in your network would most enjoy being given a good listening to, and you passing on the Golden Baton, please?
I would pass it on to a lovely author called Paul Maas, Maggrs. He's from the Northeast originally. He's got a beautiful voice in all the media he turns his hand to. He's written for literary fiction, like Modern Love and Could It Be Magic, through to gorgeous parodies and Doctor Who novels and short stories, which is how I first met him about 25 odd years ago. And he's had an extraordinary career, and can speak far more intelligently and involvingly and with fewer errs than me. So I think he'd be an excellent person to pick up that baton.
You're very kind and generous to do that. So your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to pass the golden baton to him. We're going to do a Captain's Log supplemental, by the way, where we're going to get you to read your book from within. But I'm just managing time for this bit. Now, inspired by Shakespeare and all the worlds of stage and all the men and women merely players, we're going to talk about legacy now. How, when all is said and done, Steve, would you most like to be remembered?
A poor player who strutted and fretted his hour upon the stage and then was heard no more. A tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying tea time. It is tea time, isn't it? It must be. I feel I'm ready for a cup of tea.
Yes, lovely. That was. Thank you so much for interpreting that in true Shakespeare as well. Lovely. Where can we find out more about you, Steve Cole, on the old hinterweb?
Well, you can just tap in Steve Cole books and all sorts of things pop up. A very out-of-date and Doctor Who skewed Wikipedia page. You'll find out that I'm not Steve Cole, the jazz musician.
I was going to mention him.
Yeah, sometimes.
A tenor saxophonist.
I did, indeed. I did a library event in Stevenage one time, and for some children, and this his grandfather of the boy came up to me and said, "What was it like working with blah blah and blah blah?" And I think, no, that was
no idea.
That wasn't me. That was another Steve Cole, who's, you know, shares my name, but you know, he's obviously a jazz musician. And he goes, "Right, yeah, right. But what was it like working with them?" I mean, really, I'm not making it up. You just watched my talk. Yes. I was playing a ukulele and singing about monsters. You know, I wasn't playing a beautiful jazz sax solo. But yeah, so you ignore him. You can see yes, various interviews with me where I talk about this and that.
And your Twitter handle is?
It is at Steve Cole Books. So that's the way to find me, and on YouTube, and you know, there's stuff for, you know, adults as well as for children.
Lovely. I'm just going to thank you for listening thus far. Hold the line, caller. We'll do a Captain's Log supplemental in a minute, but tune in next week for more stories from the clearing at this point. You've been listening to the Good Listening To show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from the clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
Goodbye. So, Steve, just to get your immediate feedback, what was that like being given a good listening to in this construct, would you say, as feedback?
It was very enjoyable. Thank you very much. It was, yes, good to have an opportunity to you know, consider the things that drive us and that have shaped us and motivate us as creative people. Because sometimes we're so close to the process, we don't really appreciate the tricks that our brain is playing on us to put us in this space. And when you sort of look back and see the chain of events that lead you there, you can see some of those golden threads, even as the golden apples fall around us. So it was nice to spend some time in that clearing, asking myself a few things rather than putting it all down on the page, turning a page or two back in my own memory.
Lovely. And I so loved it and enjoyed the fact that you credited your lovely English teacher for almost sort of turning the switch on, which you have everything to thank for. Wonderful.